Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello and welcome back. Hey Dad, how you doing?
Hello Tay, good. Glad to be here. How are you doing?
Doing great. The sun is shining. It is 55 degrees in February in New York City. That's probably bad for some reasons, but it's great for me.
It's probably bad for some reason, but I'm going to enjoy it.
Like nature and birds and the earth, but I got my windows open, so that's good.
Well, you're doing better than me, and I'm further south. We got a high today of 40, so, you know, we're just limping along.
It's not so bad.
Yeah, we have 40s, not too bad, but it's dropping. It's going to be colder for the next couple of days, a high in the 30s.
I know, like, we're going to have some cold weather. We'll have plenty more cold weather before it warms up for good.
Yeah.
But I feel like I always need this, like, by February, I'm just so tired of being cold. Like, I need one day where it gets above 50 to remind me that, okay, we're going to get there. You just got to hang in.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was 70 here yesterday.
Yeah? Oh, nice.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, and the cold front's moving through. But I had to, at work, I was out doing some stuff, helping out the guys in the warehouse, and I had to come out of the sweatshirt and just in a t-shirt outside, and that's the first time just in a t-shirt outside in a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I put on my normal running gear yesterday. It was a little cooler yesterday, but it was nice. And I forgot. I've gotten so used to wearing, like, the Under Armour and the Heat Tech stuff. And I just get dressed like that when I go out to my run. I'm like, oh, man, I am dying out here. Oh, it's 30 degrees warmer than it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Can I make this transition? As we move into the spring and the revival of the earth, I thought we could talk about a different revival today.
All right. It's not an old band revival. It's a old cocktail revival.
Exactly. I wanted to sort of talk about the cocktail revival. We've mentioned it a lot. We've talked a lot about the sort of renaissance of cocktails that kicked off in the 90s, and now we're all benefiting from it. But I wanted to talk about one of the major players in the early days of that. And before we get there, sort of set the stage for how we got there in the first place. How did we get so bereft in American bartending? Because there's a lot of factors to it. You know, I think that even the generation just right below me, like people that are in their 20s now, are going to grow up not realizing how good they have it, that they can walk into a bar or a restaurant even, like pretty much anywhere that has a liquor license and get a good cocktail.
Yeah, well, I can vouch for how lucky they are.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, I mean, I'm in New York City, that seems like, well, yeah, but I mean, even in Huntington, you know, when I come visit you there, there are great cocktail menus at pretty much every restaurant we've gone to clearly has somebody behind the bar that really knows their stuff.
Which is much different from what I encountered when I was in my early 20s and looking at the bar scene.
Yeah. The fact that, I mean, even for me, you know, when I was 21 in, what was that, 2008? How old am I? 2007? Early 2000s, I was of age to drink in New York City. And it still wasn't like some of the big players in the cocktail scene were established. Some of the iconic bars that really helped bring cocktail culture back. They were there, absolutely, in an operation. But it wasn't every bar. You know, my neighborhood bars in Brooklyn and Queens didn't have good cocktail menus. To now, when people that I grew up in the service industry with are opening their own bars. And, I mean, they're my friends, so they're all a bunch of, like, you know, scummy reform punk kids, but they're opening dive bars, but they're opening dive bars with a solid cocktail menu, and their bartenders know how to make a good drink. So it's just standard now. You know, I don't think that's going back in the box.
You know, it's the philosophy has changed from what it was before. When the time when I was young and hitting the bar scene, the drink idea, the what they were trying to accomplish was completely different.
Hmm. Well, I think that there's a parallel too with the food scene, which granted I'm much less versed in, and it's not quite as severe, but I think even that like, you know, that having pretty good food at any restaurant is just a standard now. You kind of can't get away with just whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. The eaters and drinkers today, you got a different thing going on out there. But
well, maybe part of it's in response to the craft beer explosion, because you've got all these different nuances in craft beer. Well, the mixed drink business better keep up with that, because you know, you got to do your exploring somewhere.
Well, and that's because that's a whole, like, we're going to talk more about how cocktails came and went today, but there's a parallel to that with the craft beer movement and also wine, the return of I mean, we lost everything in America. We didn't know how to drink wine. We didn't know how to make or drink beer, and we definitely didn't know how to make or drink cocktails for like a couple solid decades. The rest of the world was still doing all of this. So when I talk about this, you know, if you're outside of America, especially if you're in one of the other like kind of meccas for cocktailing, you're like, what, we never lost it? I'm like, no, we did though. We definitely did. So really, you know, when I say when was the beginning and end for cocktail culture, a lot of people might think, well, it's got to be Prohibition, right?
Right.
Like we didn't have cocktails being made for a decade. Like, that's not true though. I mean, it was a great disruptor during the cocktail heyday in America, and it definitely did hurt certain areas of industry. You know, namely, this is where small distilleries, a bunch of them closed down, they never opened back up. A lot of microbreweries, you know, they closed down, they never opened back up. So this starts chipping away at our American, like, creation scene. But when it comes to mixing drinks, I would say it has more of a net positive, because you have bartenders going to Europe, going to Cuba, going to Mexico. They're experiencing new spirits. They're mixing for new clientele. They're spreading the kind of ideals of American bartending around the world, but they're also going to bring that stuff back home with them when they return. Likewise, American drinkers are going and drinking in all these places. They're developing a palate for rum and tequila, things that we didn't really have, you know, in our sort of lexicon before that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also having culture sort of open up during this time period. You know, the what a bar was before Prohibition and like who could drink there, it was very divided by, you know, classes. Women didn't go to bars and drink. You know, it was a lot more rigid of a social structure. But when all drinking is illegal, you know, I think that the sort of expectations of high society go out the window. And a lot of these speakeasies that opened up had to open up sort of off the beaten path. So you had people going, you know, down into the village, the area that was sort of like where on the down low gay bars operated. You had people going to drink there. You had people going up to Harlem to drink there. Like you had a mixing of cultures, of classes, of identities, and it was just kind of fine. So,
and the one thing they all had in common, they wanted to get their drink on.
Exactly. You know, we're all breaking the law here, so who cares?
Yeah, that's right. The next round's on me.
Well, and of course, also the bartenders that were working in those speakeasies, they were working with that rough stuff, you know, that bathtub gin, that moonshine. And so they were bringing a lot of other things behind the bar to cover up those flavors. So a lot of these cocktail builds that get popular at this time, you know, adding things like seltzers and honey syrups, things that have now incorporated themselves into the lexicon of drink making, come about because we're just trying to cover up how gross this stuff is. So it's really a period of innovation for bartenders. Nothing but innovators, if nothing else. You know, I always work with what they got. Now, World War I and World War II, which bank Prohibition, are a factor to some degrees. They were, once again, very destructive to American distilling. You know, a lot of distilleries had to turn into producing war efforts, you know, making fuel or what have you. And I mean, it definitely affected how people drank. You know, while men were away at war, they weren't drinking in the bars, but you had women enter the workplace, which was pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
Then they, just as much as they went and worked in the factories and the offices, they went to the bars, you know, I don't know if this is, because a lot of times you'll hear it cited as, and women brought with them their own palate, which was lighter. And you see, like, you know, increased production of lighter beers in response to this. You know, lighter cocktails are popular. I don't love that. I think it's more of what a woman would have been expected to drink at the time, mm-hmm. factored into it.
Right.
But it, nonetheless, it does result in sort of a widening of what people drink and new things being made to meet the demands. Mm-hmm. So, not necessarily a negative. Really, the sort of end of the American cocktail bar is more at the hands of the sort of cultural zeitgeist, the expectations of you know, good moral society than any one specific factor that you can point to. After World War II ends in 45, you know, the average American family had changed, as had societal norms. You know, the women that had worked through the war had tasted autonomy. They didn't necessarily want to go back to the house. You know, you had these mixing of cultures in speakeasies and clubs. And now this, everybody was afraid because, I don't know, like, you know, gay people weren't just this theoretical boogeyman. They were real. And you had a drink next to them. And there's a lot of harsh reaction culturally to all of this. You know, you have the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare, well, really the second Red Scare, but McCarthyism comes forward and, oh, we've got to get back to the nuclear family. Women need to go back into the house and we need to reaffirm our American values, and anybody that thinks anything otherwise is probably,
a commie.
He's trying to undermine our good American values. It's a really good catch-all, you know?
Right. If you don't agree with me, you're a commie.
Exactly. And, you know, I think all these women that had to go back into the houses, this is really the era of, like those sexy ads of, like, look at this beautiful woman using a vacuum cleaner. Like, isn't she so amazing? You know, the ad campaign's just really trying to make it look so sexy and nice to just be a housewife, which is fine, and there's nothing wrong with that. But forcing the entirety of the female workplace to get back into the homes was a bit of an effort.
Yeah, what's always striking to me now is you watch the old TV shows, Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver, and the mother, who's a stay-at-home, you know, wife and mother, she's dressed in a dress. You know, throughout the day, she's wearing a dress and has the vacuum in hand, or has the latex gloves on doing the dishes and all that kind of stuff, has dinner on the table when her husband comes home at 5, you know, and that was the ideal. And that's the way it was depicted. Even the bedroom, you had twin beds in the bedroom because you wouldn't depict a man and a woman sleeping together. So they had to have twin beds in the marital bedroom.
Well, this was like 50s, right?
Cause this was, yeah, well, sort of, and 60s and going into the 70s.
Well, so by the end of World War II, I thought this was an interesting statistic. 35% of liquor was consumed in the home, whereas 65% was consumed in bars and restaurants. By 51, that percentage had basically flip-flopped. So 30% of alcohol was bought and consumed outside the home. 70% was consumed in the home. Mm-hmm. You know, this, like, the 50s was the rise of, like, the at-home cocktail party. I think also, I don't know, all those women that just had to give up their autonomy again maybe needed some drinks.
To get through the day, yeah.
Spend that whole day vacuuming in a lovely dress. You needed a pitcher of martinis to get through it. And, you know, and I mean, we're not completely DOA for cocktail bars yet. You've still got that culture of, you know, the Manhattans and old fashions, the sort of Mad Men era of cocktailing, where stiff, strong drinks are still being consumed. But the thing that really kind of, like, deals the death blow is in the next generation, the generation that's being raised in these pitcher of martini homes, and that's mm-hmm. the '60s. That's the counterculture, you know, the mm-hmm. sort of, I don't want to drink the way my dad drank. I don't want to be like him. Like, that is a big, powerful thing in really doing away with the old school cocktail bar in the '60s and forward.
Well, I think another thing that took place too, in that era, everything was wanting to be streamlined and do it faster, and it didn't matter if it was cheaper. I mean, it was to do it cheaper. It was to do it Not as good a quality, but it didn't matter as long as it was fast. I mean, let's be clear. McDonald's sprung up during that time. So the same thing was happening with food. But the drinks, everybody wanted them fast. Everybody wanted them cheap. Everybody wanted them easy. So that's where the bartending went to, is you had fast, easy to make drinks that were cheap. I mean, that's what everybody wanted when they went out. And that's what I encountered. And I really believe that has something to do with shaping why I'm a beer drinker. Because the drinks were not very good.
Yeah. Well, and that's because so many people were drinking at home, like the ready-made mixes, you know, or even like sour mix on the gun. Absolutely. Like in the atomic age, the TV dinner age, you want, it's like we didn't question if we should do it. We just questioned, could we do it? And we did.
Well, you know, there's a couple different ways. Like I when I think of the main bar that I went to that served cocktails, like when I was in college, I usually either got a screwdriver, which was just orange juice and vodka, or a tequila sunrise I thought was really fancy, which was just orange juice and tequila, and they put a shot of grenadine in there, you know? And I don't even know that it was real grenadine. Yeah. Yeah, and the red kind of hung there on top of the orange juice. Oh, that's cool. But it never tasted like much, and then a lot of times you'd go places, and you'd get a drink, and you weren't really sure if there was any alcohol in there or not. You know, you might have just been drinking mostly just all juice, and that's not fun. So the only thing that could assure me that I was getting the alcoholic intake I was expecting was to drink beer.
Well, I mean, I understand that. Yeah, because it was dark days through the... I mean, the only thing that's really kind of going on through this time period that's maybe holding on to the sort of specific kind of fussy ideals of previous generations of cocktailing is like tiki bartending. You know, that starts... It kicks off before World War II, but... Definitely afterwards, there's that renaissance of that sort of very fussy, very specific, very fresh ingredients. You know, tiki bartending is very labor intensive. But by the time we reach the 70s, that's also gone by the wayside. That is no longer popular. It's not cool anymore. I mean, that's really when we get to like the disco era and nobody's going to a bar. You've got dive bars to go and drink cheap beer and cheap alcohol. And then you've got clubs to go dance at. You're not going there to necessarily... try the cocktail.
Right. They are going to have cocktails, but that's not the main point. So what does the bar do in response? They make them cheap.
Right.
Because they're going to have them there. But you've got the disco craze. And like you say, everybody was going there for dancing. Yeah. And it, you know, it's funny. I've been listening to the 70s station more lately there on Sirius. And it's amazing to me how many instrumentals were like top hits in that era because they just wanted the long music that to just continue to dance to, and and so you had think bunch of ones no words at all, you know, and they just were music, and you don't have that nowadays. You don't have instrumentals that are big hits in the pop music scene and stuff like that. But you know, Studio 54 sprang up, and Studio 54 was the beacon of the disco era.
Well, you said you found a cocktail menu for them, right?
Yeah, I went back and looked up what did people drink at Studio 54, and they got it down to six drinks were the main drinks that were there. And here's the thing. They had all of them pre-mixed. Basically, they just poured it in a glass, and it was pre-mixed. Now, number one was Long Island iced tea.
Okay.
So they just had, you know, the gin and the vodka and tequila, triple sec, all that just mixed all up already and just poured it in your glass, you know. Then they had Dom Perignon, which, of course, there's no mixing in that.
No.
But that was something that they served on a regular basis at it. They even had, at the time, they had started in 1981, a 2000 Club, which was a group of 20 guys who bought 2,000 bottles of Dom Perignon, and they were going to celebrate on New Year's Eve 2000 with those 2,000 bottles that they had bought. And that was headed up by Andy Warhol.
Oh, that sounds right.
But I don't think that Studio 54 quite made it to 2000.
I wonder what happened to those 2,000 bottles.
I know. Somebody's got them. Then there was the Singapore Sling.
Okay.
So that was another one that was pre-mixed and made up. Now, here's another one that didn't have to be pre-mixed. They were drinking Midori.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that was a thing in the 70s.
Yeah, evidently they would just, it would just be Midori and lemon juice, I guess, is all they drank together. And then the fifth one was the grasshopper. That was one that was famous that they had there.
There you go. You could drink it Studio 54, Dad.
and then the Harvey Wallbanger.
Okay, yeah. Orange juice and Galliano.
Yeah, and that was another one that was already mixed up. Now, they said the only other thing that they went through quite a bit was the buttery nipple. They sold a lot of those, which is basically just butterscotch schnapps and Irish cream. And it's kind of like served in a shot glass.
You know, and it's funny to hear, like, these cocktails that you're, I mean, now, like, you would, not all those, like, the Singapore Sling is a good drink. But, like, you know, buttery nipple or, like, a Long Island iced tea being served next to, like, really nice champagne, and these are your options, is kind of funny. You wouldn't see that menu now.
Yeah, and they were all, like, say, they were already pre-mixed. It wasn't like they poured you a Singapore Sling and mixed it there for you or anything. Right. It was already in a big plastic jug, and they just poured it out in a glass and stuck an umbrella in it or something, you know?
Well, that's a lot of those kind of the drinks that became well-known with, like, the tiki craze were a lot of the ones that ended up as, like, instant mixes, and thus really have taken a while to recover their images, because a fresh-made Singapore Sling is very good. One from a bottle is very bad.
Yeah. Well, we learned the same thing with margaritas, didn't we?
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, I think, and maybe this is just, I prefer a fresh margarita, but there's a part of, like, a bottled instant margarita that just reminds me of, like, I don't know. I was about to say childhood, and that sounds very messed up. Oh, that's true. Because you made us, like, virgin margaritas a lot when we were kids. You know?
Yeah.
So that mix, it doesn't taste like drinking at a bar to me, but it does taste like a snow cone with a little bit more sour. But, well, so, you know, we kind of now, you know, moving past the disco era into the 80s, obviously a lot of people, you know, you kind of got like an influx of wealth into your average American home. You've got a bit of loosening of, like, social standards. You know, it's okay to go out and, like, have a drink at a bar, be single, you want places to flirt, to mingle. It makes sense that the everything that is going to go into the rebirth of the bar scene is there, but we still have some hurdles. You know, we've got, like, 70s and 80s massive influx of vodka as, like, the popular go-to spirit, you know, just massive expensive ad campaigns, everybody's drinking vodka, it's flooding the market. We still really haven't developed a taste for dark spirits. Our palate has gotten so watered down, so sweet forward, so instant mix forward, that we've got a lot of ground to recover. And you know, I think not a small factor in all this is also, like, in the 80s, you've got diet culture where, you know, everything is scary that has sugar or anything in it. Like, that's, you know, if I'm going to drink, I want something light and with juice, and that's it. But from these dark, dark days of American bartending, it emerges several figures, but the one we're going to talk about today, King Cocktail, as he's now known.
King Cocktail.
Yes, the king returns. This is, of course, Dale DeGroff, credited with playing a major part in the revival of cocktail culture in America. Now, DeGroff was born September 21st, 1948, in Rhode Island. He attended the University of Rhode Island for a while before he dropped out and came to New York City in 1969 to pursue acting. He worked an entry-level job in advertising for a little while, but he was very drawn to the bars that sort of catered to a previous generation. You know, we're talking New York City, so, I mean, it's not like cocktail culture was wiped off the map and, like, no one spoke of it. There were still nice mahogany bars in big cities, you know, with beautiful back bars and a lot of liquor. They just weren't what was popular. They weren't the thing that, you know, sold. But he went to a lot of these places and was really enamored with it. And somewhere, you know, his story is that, well, he was sitting at one of these bars, it was specifically this place called Charlie O's. He overheard a manager who was talking about, like, panicked that there was a bartender missing for this party they were supposed to be catering at the mayor's residence, the Gracie Mansion. So DeGroff offered to do the job, talked his way into it, and he did a good enough job, you know, you just went and out of nothing worked this fancy event that they kept him on. And he got his start in the service industry at Charlie O's, which was one of these beautiful old standard restaurants in Manhattan. No longer here. And that, you know, he was kind of exposed to that scene, that sort of high-end old glamour that was still existing in Manhattan at the time. He moved to L.A. in 78 to take another go at acting, but, you know, obviously had to work, so he took up a bartending gig at the Hotel Bel Air. This was an incredibly upscale establishment, had a really well-stocked bar, and he tasked himself with familiarizing himself with every spirit on the back bar. Just tasting it, reading the label, trying to understand what it was. I think it's pretty cool. Like, you know, just educated himself with what he had on hand. He had the stuff.
So they found him laying there sometimes amongst a pile of empty bottles, and he said, "Hey, it's an education, isn't it?"
No. Not all at once. One at a time.
That's the kind of studying I like.
It's funny because that's when I was first getting my start, I was bar backing at a very well-stocked bar. And as my staff drink, I would just ask for, "Can I try that?" And I mean, sometimes it was like a nice spirit. Like, "Oh, this is my first time trying like cachaça." Like, "Oh, I don't know anything about it, you know." And I'd bug the bartender to tell me what cachaça was. But then sometimes it would just be like a liqueur, and the bartender was like, "Yeah, you can try it. Like, that's it. That's your staff drink. But you're going to be drinking like a shot glass of violet liqueur."
Yeah.
Come to Violette. I'm like, "Okay, I just want to try it." So I get that like urge to like just, I want to understand everything that's behind me.
Yeah.
Like, I want to know what it does. DeGroff ended up, getting married, having some kids. He moved back to New York City, kind of got back in with the people he'd worked with before, specifically Joe Baum, who was a well-known, renowned New York City restaurateur at that time, had opened a lot of big, prominent places. And he wanted to open a bar. The first one was Aurora, which was going to be sort of a return to the classic cocktail bar. You know, he wanted no soda guns, no instant mixes, everything fresh and classic. And he urged DeGroff to check out a book that might help him set up a bar like this. It was Jerry Thomas's 1862 How to Mix Drinks. So this, you know, kind of lost tome of classic cocktailing that DeGroff seeks out and really becomes this is a very important moment. It's, you know, it's important moment to why we now can walk in a bar and get a good old fashioned is this moment where DeGroff chooses to seek out this old weird book from over a century ago and build a bar around it. And the success of Aurora led to DeGroff being put in charge of a bigger project, and that's the reopening of Rockefeller Center's iconic Rainbow Room in 1987.
Well, I think that's amazing that it's not like they needed somebody of today to figure out, here's what we can do to create good drinks. They had to go back to the beginning when they didn't have all the pre-done stuff and all the sugary drinks and all that kind of stuff. Back to what did people have at the time to make drinks and do that. I think that's amazing.
Well, it really is the beginning. I mean, that's, you know, a lot of times Jerry Thomas is considered one of the fathers of American bartending. But, I mean, his big thing is he's one of the first people to just write things down.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't have to invent it. You just had to write it down and remember it. Everybody else was staggering home. They didn't remember it.
I know. This is like going back to, like, bartender hieroglyphics is what we're doing here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now a little bit of history about the Rainbow Room. It opened actually back in 1934. It was founded by J.D. Rockefeller, the oil baron, who, interestingly enough, was not a drinker. He famously did not consume alcohol, but he did want a spot that would be this high glamour, like the creme de la creme for actors and performers and socialites in New York City. And obviously, if you're going to do that, you've got to have alcohol. So he wanted it to be the best of the best. And it stayed that way for a while, but definitely it's fallen off by the 80s. You know, the cool young socialites didn't go to Rockefeller Center to get drunk in the 80s. They went down to the Village, you know. They went down to, like, the clubs and the cool bars down there. So it really lost its glamour. So this closing and reopening with a bit of an updated look happened in 87, and that's when DeGroff launched his program. he did, you know, poured a ton of research into this. He had a massive team, like 37 bartenders. He had a 30-drink menu of classics. That's a massive menu to
learn
and execute properly.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of them were probably on the simple side. You know, you probably had your Sazeracs and your old fashions, but then also, like, complicated drinks, a proper Singapore sling, you know. So definitely, like, an immense undertaking, but it had a resounding effect. All of a sudden, you know, like, de Groff tells it, like, he could go to a bar, you know, like, in the you know, lower Manhattan, and they'd have maybe only two or three cocktails now on a new cocktail menu, but those would be drinks that he knew he personally had sort of brought back from the dead.
Yeah.
So somebody had said at his bar, tried it, and said, I like this. I'm going to take this back to my bar. Which is really cool, you know, that, like, he became a hub of knowledge that disseminated throughout the city and, obviously, throughout the country as well, because you had people drinking at the Rainbow Room that were then, you know, bi-coastal or traveling the world, people coming as tourists and drinking there. So it was a great epicenter to influence culture as a whole.
Well, and let's face it, you had a whole generation of drinkers that were like me that had come up through this snappy, quick type thing, and that's what you got when you got a drink. And nobody's born knowing what a good drink is. You have to experience it. So this was probably their first experience getting a really well-made drink and saying, you know what? There's a difference between that and just slopping some stuff together in a glass because it's got alcohol.
And I think one thing that really, if we talk about, I mean, because him bringing back these recipes, there were other bartenders around the world that were starting to do this, but the thing that I think really also matters about him is, you know, I mentioned that he came to New York and then went to LA to be an actor, and you might take this to be like, well, acting didn't work out for him, so he became a bartender. I don't think that's true at all. I think one thing that he understood is that show of, you know, it's not like, oh man, now I've got to wait, you know, 5 minutes for my bartender to make my drink, whereas it used to just be off a gun. He made a show of the whole making of the drink, not like showy flair flipping bottles in the air, but just making everything by hand, the craft of it. He was an amazing performer when he made drinks. Like, he knew how to hold court at a bar, which is also something that Jerry Thomas was renowned for, so he definitely, you know, was influenced by that. But, like, that's the thing that I think he brought back, was that watching your bartender take time and effort and make you something special was part of the experience. It wasn't something we need to do away with for, you know, speediness. It was part of the process.
Well, I think that you attract a different kind of drinker to your bar, too, because there's some people, let's face it, you just go out and you're drinking all you can because you want to get drunk. There's other people that may enjoy the whole experience, and they enjoy sipping on a good drink, and their goal isn't to get drunk. Their goal is to sit there and enjoy a good cocktail and a good conversation.
Well, and I think it gets to the heart of what good hospitality service is, because at the end of the day, you know, any of us, especially nowadays, any of us could buy, like, a solid how to make cocktails book. In fact, Dale DeGroff probably has the perfect books. If you want to find a great, like, I just want to learn how to bartend, Dale DeGroff has several books that are amazing and covers classic cocktails. I could buy that book, buy some bottles, go home and make myself a drink and save myself a lot of money. But that element of being taken care of, I think sometimes we forget in hospitality that that's the missing thing that you go to a bar to. Not just drink that drink that you could make at home for a quarter of the cost. You want someone to make it for you, and you want someone to care about making it for you. Like, there's an element of being taken care of that it happens in, you know, the kindness, the presentation, the atmosphere, but it really happens just in the act of caring about what goes in the glass. Like, I think that comes through when you drink it.
Yeah, well, I can tell you this. When we were at the Dead Rabbit, I could tell that those drinks were made by somebody who wanted to make good drinks.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't just thrown in there because I would have drank whatever they gave me. But, you know, but it, you could tell that that drink was made with a purpose.
Yeah. That's what I think. That's really the thing that, like, is I mean, of he's got a massive legacy in the cocktail world. And, I mean, he's obviously still, you know, he's has books. He has his own bitters. He heads up several important, like, you know, like, bar programs. He's still massively influential. But if there's, if you could boil his legacy down to one thing, I think he returned the care to cocktailing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And it is. It's on both ends, in the maker and the drinker.
Yeah.
There's a care to having it done right.
Well, and that's sort of, you know, not the only figure, and definitely in future episodes we'll hit some of the other major players, because there's a handful of them that all have their own cool story, but I thought if we were going to start somewhere, we have to start with King Cocktail himself.
Well, if you're the king, you got to start with the king.
Yeah, I met him once, not in any, like, didn't get to have a conversation, but I was lucky enough to work an event where he was a featured bartender. That has been probably about a decade now. But, you know, I get it. Like, he's absolutely, like, magnetic when he makes a drink. Like, you can't, and it's not the showy stuff. I abhor flair in bartending. Mm-hmm. When I see a bartender, like, flip a tin around, I'm like, I mean, like, you know, in your hand real quick, fine. But, like, up in the air to make a big scene, I'm just annoyed, you know, throwing bottles around and splashing liquor as you go. I'm just like, why?
Like Tom Cruise in Cocktail. You weren't impressed with that, huh?
No. That is the opposite of what I like. I worked at a place where there was flair was sometimes allowed, and it all takes me back to one night where I was working with this bartender who was just, he was already a jerk, and he was trying to, like, practice his tin flips, and I was his bar back. He kept throwing his tins on the floor when he was doing it, and I mean, he had a lineup of like five tins, and one by one, he'd flip it, it would fall to the floor, and I'd have to pick it up off the floor and wash it. And then he'd flip another one, I'd have to pick it up off the floor and wash it. And then a customer was trying to order from him, so here he had thrown all of his tins on the floor, and I was washing them all, and he's like, I need a tin. I'm like, yeah, well, you should have thought about that before you threw them on the floor.
Quit throwing them on the damn floor, and you'll have a tin.
That's the epitome of a flair bartender for me, because it's like, you're at that point, the show becomes about, look how cool I am. And it's not about, I care about you as my customer, so I'm making this drink with absolute care. That's the difference for me. And it's a subtle difference. And it's sometimes hard to tell what kind of bartender you have, especially in this day and age where the celebrity bartender is such a thing, where the cool, showy, professional mixologist is such a thing. I don't think that's what DeGroff represents. I think he represents doing it the right way, where I'm taking every step with painstaking care, because I want you to have the best experience I can provide you. Part of that is watching me and putting on this little show for you, but it's not, the show isn't about, look how cool I am. It's about, look how good this drink is I'm making for you.
When you talk about flair, I can't help but think about that Jennifer Aniston scene in Office Space. And
the
flair. You didn't wear enough flair. The pins or whatever that they're wearing are there.
I'm kind of shitting on flair. I think it's cool that you can do those things. People that can do it, they're competitions. They're flair competitions. I think it's cool. It's just, it's not bartending to me. It's tricks. It's like
juggling. And it's not necessary to make a good drink.
No. I've heard functional flair be the term that some bartenders use. It's like, it looks cool, but it goes into the process of making the drink, and that's fine. Like, you know.
Well, I think you have that. When I watch you mix your drinks, you're confident in your pours and your delivery and stuff like that. Whereas with me, I'm like, I'd say I'm almost there to 2 ounces. Oh, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Oh, there we go. Okay, then I dump it in the tin. Most of it went in. You know, yeah. I missed a little bit, but not too much.
As long as the drink gets made, I think. The care has to come first, I think, to making a good drink. And
yeah.
So, you know, unfortunately, the Rainbow Room is not, it's no longer a hub of drink making at all. It's there for private events now. It doesn't exist as a bar you can belly up to. But
there are lots of good ones to choose from.
Well, and his protégés have opened amazing bars all around the city and around the world. I mean, his influence is, you know, you can go sit at a lot of bars in New York City that are there because Dale DeGroff did what he did. So it's not like you can still drink those drinks with all that care. You just can do it in multiple places instead of the one.
Well, and whether he had a hand in a bar like that or not, he did have a hand in creating the culture that allows bars like that to thrive now.
Yeah. And it's that, you know, that take your time. Like, the customer needs to sit down and take his time. The bartender, take your time. Like, that was that thing that really, you know, I love that. Like, I fast-paced cocktail bars always kind of feel like anachronistic to me. Like, what, you don't need, no, I'll wait 5 minutes. I'll wait 10 minutes for a good drink. That's fine. I want you to make mm-hmm. it right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there you go. Like I said, one of many. I don't want to, it's not all him, but, you know, this wouldn't be a historical booze podcast without giving some time to the one and only Dale DeGroff.
The king. Did he have his crown on? Did he have his crown on when you met him that time a decade ago?
I've never seen him in a crown. I do know, like, oh. I worked with his son on an event too, and I've seen that his son is sometimes called Prince Cocktail, which I think is cute. Cocktail royalty. Okay, sure.
The littlest prince.
Yes. But all right. Well, there you go. So check out. He's got a couple books out there, but they're great books on classic cocktails. If you really just want. You know, if you're a novice, like, home bartender, and you want to just have those standard recipes, that's exactly what his books are for. He's got a really good brand of bitters out there if you want to check that out. But that's Dale DeGroff, and that's the beginning of the renaissance of American drink making.
All right, that's what got me able to drink a drink again, something besides beer.
I know. I love that. Like, when you joined the show, I was like, man, I know Dad doesn't like cocktails, but, like, hopefully this will work out. And it makes me so happy each time that, like, we make a drink that you actually then go on and make for yourself.
Yeah. Well, that's happening more and more often these days.
Hey, it's never too late to enjoy something new.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you, Dad, for being here.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me. I always learn something, and once again, I've learned more new stuff.
There you go. Thank you all for listening. Thank you especially to the members of our Patreon. That is, if you're curious about that, if you want to support the show, for as little as $1 a month, you can get access to our videos. Moving forward, they're going to be, not all of them, but the podcast videos are going to be Patreon exclusives, so if you want to check that out. And if you want to email us, you can email us at neatthebooscast@gmail.com. If you want to find us on social media, we are neatboozcast on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to go talk about, I don't know, your favorite classic cocktail or how cool Dale DeGroff is, you can do that in a forum.
On Meet the Boozcast group page on Facebook in the metaverse. Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of cool people there. They post pictures of the drinks they make and talk about it. It's a real awesome little community, so check that out.
Yeah, it's a great group.
All right, well, hey, I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been...
Me. Yeah, I think that the Dead Rabbit was the first place that I went where I really felt like that the drinks are, you know, an experience, not just a drink.
I feel like now it's almost like we're getting on the other end of it, where it's become so standard to have, like, a really cool cocktail bar that it's almost like it's just assumed, so nobody treats it like it's special anymore. Like, no, we had it right there for a second. Let's go back to that.
Yeah.
We're back to, like, pre-batching the super fussy high-end cocktail. Like, no, don't do that.